pleasure to have here Sung Kei telling us about S matrices and massless particles.
Thank you.
So today I'll talk about some works I've been doing.
Some work with Freddie and his student Alice that we found a new formulation at the moment for the tree level, the complete tree level S matrices of massless particles. So by massless particles, I'll mainly focus on graphitons and gluons, but later we'll see that there are also many interesting stories for scalars and photons and so on. So basically, in principle, it applies to all quantum field theory with massless particles. So I'll basically first give you some motivation for studying this object. This is a very old and very important object that we want to find some new insights into it. And the second, I'll give you the general proposal of expressing this S matrix, not as summing over Feynman diagram, but as an integral over the moduli space of a Riemann sphere. So just like a string theory, but now it's for amplitudes in quantum field theory. And the second part, I will give you concrete examples as very compact formula for the complete tree-level graviton scattering and also gluon scattering amplitudes. And then in the third part, I will try to extend the story to many other theories. So first, just some introduction into this new formulation. So we all know how to compute S matrices, right? So we know that the amplitude has this. So we prepare n momenta to scatter in this picture. So we have this particles that we can label them all as incoming, and they carry this momentum. In our case, all this momentum will be non because these are massless particles. And then we want to study the S matrix, which carries this momentum conserving delta function and this part. So today I'll focus on this momentum delta function stripped part of the S matrix. So how to compute it? We all know that, for example, we can computed from Feynman diagrams, just by definition of the, by giving the Feynman rule from the Lagrangian of the theory. So this is an example of the scattering of two gluon to four gluon. So you will need such a cross section to prepare yourself for the experiment data from LHC, for example. So this is the propagator and 3 and 4 vertices of the gluons. You need such Feynman diagram. You need many, many more. So actually, there's something interesting that some people in the 70s predict that this calculation is too complicated, that they say it's probably never going to be done analytically. And it's indeed, if you consider that the 6 gluon scattering amplitude, it has hundreds of Feynman diagrams. And if you plug in the Feynman rules, it has thousands of terms. And finally, in 1985, I want to just entertain you with this little story that tells us that it's really difficult to compute such S matrices. In 1985, Park and Taylor, they took this challenge of computing this thousands of terms from hundreds of Feynman diagrams, and the answer is like 8 pages of all these contractions, like the polarization contraction with momentum and momentum contractions of this particle. So just 6 particle, you know, you have this particle as K1, it carries some polarization epsilon 1, K2, epsilon 2, and so on. So if you want to compute this Feynman diagram, the final answer takes 8 pages, and they use the best computer they had back then. And some miracle just happened 1 year after that, because in this paper, they actually say that this is like some result that will make the experimental physicists to be happy, but not the theoretical physicists. So they try to simplify it to a form that will be welcomed by the theorists. And it turns out to be just a single term formula. So out of this 8-page result, what they discover is that for the simple case that called people usually call MHV, meaning maximal helicity violating amplitude. So if you have the gluon, two gluons carrying negative helicity, so this gluon carry either -1 or +1 helicities, and the rest carrying positive helicity, in this special configuration, the final answer of this all this calculation reduced to this expression. So I want you to get familiar with this this expression, because we're going to use it later. This is a famous Park-Taylor formula that has also a prefactor taking into account the two negative helicity guys are here. So this is the generator of this gluon. So you can regard it as generating SU3, or in general, you can put an UN group here or SUN group here. That each such trace represents a color ordering of these gluons. And this is simply the amplitude for that color ordering. So you just take the difference of this Z variable that I'm going to define in a second, that is the miraculous spinner helicity variable that makes this expression so simple. So what are these Z variable? Basically, you just, in 4D, you know that your four momentum, K, can be written in terms of this Pauli matrices. It's a 2x2 matrix times some, there might be a overall constant, but times this two vectors that I call 1ZA and 1ZA bar. So these are the definition of this spinner variables, if you want, ZA and ZA bar, together with this 2x2 Pauli matrix. This define you always a null four vector. And the miracle for this object is that only Z variable appear in this six particle scattering amplitude. So of course, Z bar also appear in the momentum conserving part, but the if you strip that off, this part is completely holomorphic, only depend on the Z. So this is a, this is the suggestion that first suggestion that we actually that our way of computing S matrices are very, very redundant. We take 8 pages of result, which just simplify to this. So and then there are summing over permutations of these orderings. So this is just one particular ordering. You need to sum over the rest. So very natural question just arise. I mean, is this miraculous simplification a special feature of this helicity configuration? I mean, sorry, they actually generalize it to any number of particle. So this is the six particle answer that they get is n equals 6. But later, it's very easy to extend, just say, OK, let's put all the particles here. And it turns out to work for this helicity configuration for any number of particles. So is this something special? What about other helicities? In 4D, that's the first question, right? So you can also ask, what about gravity? I mean, this is just the amplitude in Yang-Mills theory. You can ask about gravity. You can ask about other theories, and also in other space-time dimension. So is this something very special in 4D? So when I showed you the 8-page result, that is written in general dimension. Somehow in 4D, in this special variable, it's simplified to this way. And you can, something more important is actually, is there a formulation of that of all this amplitude, including Yang-Mills theory or gravity, that actually manifests some properties we would like the amplitude to have? For example, the gauge invariance, its soft limits or factorization, and other very interesting properties of the theories we're interested. So for example, this is obviously the nicest expression you can have for this scattering. It tells you that the theories, there's gauge invariance, there's many properties of that special amplitude, but is there a general formulation that can manifest them all? So this is the questions I want to to answer in this talk. So actually, the first question is answered by Witten in 2003 when he proposed his twisted string formula for any Young Mills amplitude. Actually, it's the maximally supersymmetric theory in 4D. But at tree level, they're equivalent, so you can extract all the gluon amplitude from that theory. So his main observation is that this is not just a variable that works in this special helicity configuration. Actually, you should view this, you should take this structure more seriously. So this is an indication that there is actually a Riemann sphere living there with some punctures here. So you have n particle scattering. So probably this suggests that you want to consider a Riemann sphere with n punctures, such that this puncture has basically got identified or linearly mapped to this z. So for example, if you have sigma 1 and z1 is essentially just sigma 1. And then you compute a correlator on this CP1, that some very natural correlator for Witten's twisted string theory. You can define this correlator on the CP1 that naturally gives you this denominator structure. And it happens in this helicity configuration that your kinematics, your momentum, Ka, is actually related to this puncture in this simple way, such that the answer is so simple. So in other helicity configuration, his proposal is that you always compute your string correlator on this worksheet CP1. It always gives you this correlator, but the map between the kinematic data and this puncture on the sphere becomes more complicated. It's no longer a linear map. This spinners can become some high degree polynomial map in terms of the puncture. So this is the essential idea that enables Witten to solve all the gluon amplitude in 4D. I mean, it's grouped into this n equals 4 supermultiplier, but that is considered to be solved. And it triggers a lot of progress in understanding scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 in QCD, and also in like gravity theories like n equals 8 and so on. So you probably heard of BCFW recursion relation and other method of computing amplitude. They are kind of inspired by Witten's theory. So despite all that progress, it hasn't really answered this question, or especially this question, because there are some technique that allows you to compute amplitudes in QCD or in gravity, but still it doesn't really answer, can you make these properties manifest? Can you write the whole amplitude as a single object rather than, you know, coming from recursion relation or summing over diagrams and so on? So we're trying to, and also most developments have been focusing on very special theories and in 4D. So in this talk, we're trying to generalize, and basically we want to propose that all the QFTs with massless particles can be written in a fashion very similar to Witten's proposal, but now generalized. Okay, so the basic building block for us is still this moduli space. This moduli space of, so this, we define this M0N, this is genus 0. This is the moduli space of N punctured Riemann spheres. So what is this object? I just want to give you a basic idea that if you have, for example, if you have N equals 4, just 4 points, we know that on a sphere we have a symmetry, SL2C symmetry of this sphere. So you can actually use that symmetry to fix 3 of the punctures. So for 4 points, there's only one puncture that hasn't been fixed on the sphere. So for example, if you fix like sigma 1, sigma 3, and sigma 4 to be 0, 1, and infinity, and all you're left is just the position of the sigma 2. So this space M04 is the space for this position. Okay? So it basically looks like this. You can draw it that you found that it has 3 singularities. So it's a smooth space that has singularities when sigma 2 equals 0, when sigma 2 equals 1, and when sigma 2 equals infinity. So these are the 3 boundaries of your space M04. And what does it tell you? It actually tells you that these 3 boundaries wanted to be matched into the physical singularity of your amplitude. Because if you consider your scattering amplitude, you have this K1 all the way to K1, K2, K3, K4 as your massless momenta. And you can define this Mandelstam variables. For example, S is the sum of K1 and K2 squared. T is, say, K2 and K3. And U is K1 and K3, for example. And by momentum conservation, you know S plus T plus U equals 0. So this is your kinematic data. And this space actually knows this space. The boundary of this space is mapped in one-to-one correspondence into this space. So for example, you have this S axis and T axis, and this is the U equals 0. So S 0, T equals 0. So these three singularities are exactly these three lines on this space. So whenever your physical system have a singularity, your amplitude factorized on some, when some sum of momentum go on shell, this space must be able to know it. Because I want to build a map that from each puncture to each K. And the purpose of that map is really want to, instead of considering the boundary of my kinematic invariance, I see the boundary of this moduli space. So how do I build such a map? This is the origin of our scattering equation. So actually you want to first build a map from this n puncture sphere into the light cone of your momentum space. Could be a d-dimensional momentum space. So this is our construction. I'm going to tell you how do we build a map that knows for any number of particles the physical singularities from its moduli space. So basically we call this map, say, W of z. This is the point of z that maps to the momentum space. And we ask for two important properties for this map. The first one is that it wants to map each puncture into a momentum, right? So basically, this is what you're gonna ask, that your map, this differential form, if you integrate it, contour integrate along a small circle around any puncture, you should reproduce this momentum K for each particle. So for A from 1 to N. This is the first requirement. It's just telling you that you want to map each puncture into a moment. And this is already very nice because you will say, oh, the k's are subject to momentum conservation, right? So what is this? This is simply the residue at infinity for my map. So let me show you. So this condition translating to the condition that your map is actually written as a summing over all the particles with this degree minus 1/4 that with residue written by this momentum. So if you plug this in here, you get this. And the residue at infinity for this guy, when you take z to infinity, obviously the sum of the momentum. So the momentum conservation has translated into our construction a condition that the map doesn't have a pole at infinity. This is very important. To build this, so it's a map that's holomorphic everywhere except on these punctures. This is the map. The second very important constraint is that I haven't told you anywhere here that this momentum are non-vectors. So we're describing some massive particle scattering. So actually it's not enough that just to map each point into a light cone. I want to map the whole sphere onto the light cone. That is the key of this construction. So I require the second point, which is this W is null for any z. So this is the starting point. I said that I want to map the whole sphere onto the light cone. So what does this mean? So this simply translates into this double summation that you have AB from 1 to N, KA dot KB, with this z minus sigma A and z minus sigma. So you want this rational function of z to vanish identically. So what does this mean? The meaning of this is that you have two types of pole you want to consider. One is the double pole when A equals B, right? The other type is the simple poles when A different from B. So if when for the double poles, you can easily see that The requirement that it vanishes is identical to the massless condition for each particle. So if you consider a double pole A equals B, it just tells you all the Ka squared is zero. This is for the double pole. And the second thing is for the single pole. So if you look at, let me maybe write this somewhere else. So if you look at each single pole of the form z equals sigma a, the residue is very easily to be written down as b summing over b from 1 to n, and b different from a of this ka of kb, and sigma a minus sigma b. So actually, this is the residue at z equals sigma a for the single pole. So you want all this residue also vanish. So this tells you that for a from 1 to n, you want this combination to vanish. So this is the scattering equation that we found. So the scattering equation is nothing that we impose arbitrarily. It's just some natural, is the outcome of this natural construction that you want to build a map from the Riemann sphere to the light cone. So you have to satisfy this condition. So this actually tells you that there's some connection between your external kinematics. So this is these are all the kinematic invariants of your particle, so you can write them as Ka dot Kb for all the A and B. There's a connection among these scattering equations, via these scattering equations, there's this connection that connects all these kinematic invariants to the space of all the punctures. So given all these kinematic invariants, you want to use this equation to solve these punctures, the position of these punctures.
So when you have more particles than there are dimensions of space-time, don't you have more relations among the kinematic invariants?
Yes. So here you can, so actually there's something, you can view it differently. If you fix the number of particles, this construction is generally works in infinite dimension. And if you start to reduce the number of dimensions, there can be some degeneration that will happen. So especially in 4D and 3D, you will see that things can become very, very special. But in general dimension, this is the map. But it's not a one-to-one map. So actually, given the kinematics, you can find many solutions that the punctures were labeled. So
is it one-to-one, though, if the number of particles is less than the dimension?
No, it's not one-to-one. So it's always a polynomial equation that when you solve, there are many solutions. But I'll immediately say that. So the second thing you notice is that there's not only an SL2C on your sphere on this variables. So as I told you from the beginning, you can fix three of them, and you only need to solve the remaining n minus three variables. But there are also an SL2C symmetry of the equations. So here I told you that there are n equations, but there are actually three of them that's redundant. So you can take the sum of all of them, it gives you zero by momentum conservation, and you can multiply them by sigma a or sigma a squared, and do the sum, you can check that it's also zero. So there are three redundancies, SL2C redundancies of this equation. So it means that there are n minus three equations. But it's not just one solution. So these are generally polynomial equations. So if you solve it, you find there are n minus three factorial solutions. So this is the fact that you can prove by studying some limit of these equations that you can find this is a, so if you can even, this is the simplest form you can write down the equation, but if you try to make it a polynomial equation, you can see directly that it's always a polynomial of degree n minus three factorial. So for four particle, it's a linear equation, but already five particle, it's a quadratic equation and so on. So it's never very easy to solve these scattering equations for very large number of particles because they are always of high degree, but you can do that. And that's for generic kinematics. So if your kinematics are, there's no singularity, it didn't hit those singularity, there are always a minus three factorial solution. But when you hit those singularities, you encounter less solutions. So it's the third point that the physical singularity of your system, when a sum of momentum go onshell, is always reflected by the singularities of this modular space, or of these solutions. So whenever your a subset of your particle, their momentums add up to the own shell, the Riemann sphere, you begin to study, there's always some solution that the Riemann sphere also factorized into two Riemann sphere. So these are the points you start with to put their momentum own shell, the sum of their momentum own shell. So when this summing over this particle momentum get own shell, the whole system split into two system of scattering equations such that this will reflect the factorization of your tree amplitude in general. So these are some very interesting properties that you can study. For example, you can study a five-point system of this. Just two equations for two variables. You can simplify them into a quadratic equation, and you will see all the things I've said. There's very rich, already very rich structure of physical singularity of a five-particle amplitude, because you can go on shell. It factorizes into a three-particle and four-particle. And the four-particle guy can, again, go to a singularity. So there are co-dimension one and two boundaries. And these are all mapped into the interesting boundaries of your modular space. So this is our construction for the scattering amplitude. Yeah.
So it's only in the case of four particles that you have a one-to-one map between this moduli space and the kinematic data?
A one-to-one map. Yes, only for four particles. Yeah. Yeah. Already for five particles, you start to have, for example, for five particles, in general, each point, so each kinematic data will map into 2 points on your moduli space. And when you go to a boundary, it's only 1 point. Yeah. So on the co-dimension one boundary, it's a one-to-one map. So here's our proposal for writing down any scattering amplitude with massless particle, with n massless particle, at tree level using this equation. So the amplitude we're interested in, we write it as an integral over the moduli space. On the support of scattering equation, just keep repeating this equation with some arbitrary with some function, some rational function that can depend on that must depend on sigma, and it can depend on the external momenta, and also anything else you want to have, like the polarization or your color, and so on. Depends on what theory you consider. So this is actually an existence proof that whenever you have a local and unitary tree level amplitude, you can rewrite it this way. That you can always build a rational function of sigma and other data. Of course, that's not very useful in practice, because if you already know that, the form of the amplitude, you don't need this. So really the point is that we, given any theory, we want to search this space of theories to see what are these, can we find very simple objects here that tells you how to compute the amplitude and also manifest those properties of the amplitude. For example, for gravity, for Yamil theory, and so on. But there is this existence proof that this formula always works. So here by prime actually mean that there's SL2C redundancy. So when you have a prime, we mean that you have only n minus 3 guys involved, and there will be a Fadiev Popov factor here. So if you exclude three particles, you have to accompany with a Jacobian when you exclude. So here we exclude three integration variables because they are fixed, and here we exclude three scattering equation because there is this redundancy. So later we just call this part the measure d mu of n for n particles. So this is a general construction, and I want to also emphasize that there's nothing mysterious about this integral. There's not really any integral to do, because all your sigmas are fixed. They are solutions of this polynomial equation. So really what this formula means is that you want to sum it over all the solutions of your integrand that depends on sigma and others, divided by a Jacobian. That has a very nice form that I don't want to write down here. The Jacobian is simply the determinant of this derivative matrix coming from the delta function here, right? So this is the general form. I mean, you can easily play with any integrand you found here, as a rational function of this sigma. Say at 5 particle, you just sum it over 2 solutions from that quadratic equation, and you do this sum with a determinant. So this is in practice how we compute amplitude. Once we know the function there, we can sum it over all the solutions. Of course, you need to solve those equations, but once you get the solution, you can use it to compute any amplitude you want. Okay, so enough for the general. Okay, one last thing is that I want to mention that if you want to play this game, this I cannot be something very arbitrary. Already from this construction, the measure has to, so the whole formula has to be SL2C invariant, right? This is a symmetry of the system. And this measure part is actually not invariant under SL2C, it's covariant. So it picks up some SL2 weight when you do the transformation. So this measure has to have SL2 weight for each particle minus 4. Minus 4 is the weight for each particle. So for example, if you say, oh, can we just use this guy, this Park-Taylor answer, with the Z being the sigma to plug it in there, it won't work. It only accounts half of the integrand because you have each particle here appear twice in the denominator. Its weight is minus 2. So just to make the formula mathematically consistent, to write an SL2 invariant formula, you need this guy to have SL2. So you need each label to appear in the denominator 4 times. So this is the first thing you want to remember about the construction. So now I just want to go to the second part. I give you the very simple formula for say n graviton scattering and also n gluon scattering. Namely, I will give you the form of that I for these two theories. So immediately I can tell you what's the gravity S matrix in this form. Remember that if I want to compute it for Feynman diagram, it's basically hopeless. I mean, this is already very so difficult for gluons. For gravitons, you have infinite number of vertices, and even the three-point vertices I don't want to write down here. So instead, I'll give you our formula gives you something extremely simple, as you will see now. So the construction relies on a 2n by 2n matrix I'll call psi. So it has this form of 4 blocks. It's an anti-symmetric 2n by 2n matrix where each part is an n by n matrix. So you have this A part, you have this B part, and you have C, and you have minus C transpose because it's an anti-symmetric matrix. So to write all these guys explicitly, you will see that the first part, the n by n matrix A, is very similar. The entries are very similar to what appear in the scattering equation. So for example, this part looks like k1 dot k2 over sigma 1 minus sigma 2 for its entry for 1 and 2. And then similarly, the last one is k1 dot kn. Sigma 1 minus sigma n. And here is anti-symmetric, so it's k2, k1, sigma 2 minus sigma 1, kn dot k1, sigma n minus sigma 1. So this is just the A part of your matrix. And similarly, you have a B part of your matrix, where you only replace this k dot k by the contraction of polarizations. So here you have epsilon 1 dot epsilon 2 all the way to epsilon 1 dot epsilon n. And similarly, the anti-symmetric lower part. But now the interesting thing is for the C part. So what can they be? They must have this epsilon dot k part that will appear in your final answer. So actually, I will write down the diagonal piece later. But the off-diagonal piece is also very, very similar to this construction. So you have a k1 dot epsilon 2 and a k1 dot epsilon n. So this is all the way to cnn. And here you can have this k2 dot epsilon 1. No, these are not related by a minus sign, because this will relate a minus sign to here. This is kn dot epsilon 1, sigma n minus sigma 1. And this is its transpose. I can just write minus C11, epsilon 1 dot K2, epsilon 1 dot Kn. Just to give you the idea what this matrix looks like. So it's a very simple matrix of this four blocks. Each of them has the contraction you want, either K dot K, epsilon dot epsilon, or K dot epsilon. And the claim is that the gravity amplitude, so the complete tree level graviton and graviton scattering amplitude can be written as essentially the determinant of this matrix. So this is the construction that tells you all this complicated Feynman diagram should sum up into a simple formula that I said is a summing over a solution of a determinant over a determinant, if you want, because the Jacobian is, again, a determinant. So the prime means that actually, similar to the SL2C symmetry there are two non-vector of this matrix. So when you compute this determinant, it's zero. So you have to delete two columns and two rows. So how do I convince you that this is the right answer for the graviton scattering? I won't compute anything for you. If you're interested, you can go full graviton scattering is already very interesting that you only have one solution, but you will see how this determinant becomes the TA tensor and so on. And the interesting thing is that I can convince you this is the right answer by showing that it has all the properties the n-graviton amplitude wants to satisfy. First of all, it's permittivity invariant. This is already quite non-trivial because if you use any other method to compute gravity amplitude, say BCFW recursion and so on, the permittivity invariant is something very difficult to show. You have to single out some particle. But here it's basically transparent from this determinant of this matrix. And also it has this interesting property that we know it must have, which is it's multilinear in the graviton polarization tensor, which is written as two copy of this polarization vectors. I mean, they are the same vectors. That's why it's traceless and symmetric. So this multilinearities can be seen from the expansion of this determinant. And also it has the correct mass dimension and so on. But most important is this, some other property. Most important is this gauge invariance. That's very difficult to realize from any other method. For example, each individual Feynman diagram doesn't have to be gauge invariant. If I give you a huge expression of a million Feynman diagrams, how do you know the final answer is gauge invariant? This is transparent from our construction because I haven't told you what the CA, what's the diagonal piece. So CAA is simply the sum of each column of this. So CAA is this B different from A from 1 to N. Epsilon A dot KB. So this is also very similar to the scattering equation form, except this is epsilon rather than K. So you can, this zero is actually also can be written like this. And due to the scattering equation, this becomes zero. So just look at this matrix, you will see why this is gauge invariant. So gauge invariant means that I want to shift my each of my polarization vector by its momentum. Amount proportional to its momentum. And the whole amplitude should be invariant under this. So this is very, very interesting to see from this construction because if you replace, say, epsilon 1 by k1 from here, from, say, this first column from the lower part, you see that it exactly becomes the first column of the upper part. And also for this c11 becomes 0 because of scattering equation. So if you replace this by ka, this obviously goes to zero. So this is a property that we don't know any other representation of your amplitude can make manifest. But here is simply that you make any replacement like this, the two column and row of this matrix just become identical and the vanishing is obvious. Of course, in the end, I have to show you something that I won't have time to do today, but this is also very crucial, is that when you have any sum of momentum go on shell, I told you that the scattering equation factorizes, but also the determinant of this matrix will factorize into a left part and right part, exactly with a middle particle also as a graviton. So you have to sum it over the polarization of that intermediate particle. So the amplitude will go to like M left, M right with a propagator, and some tensor structure here that you sum it over its polarization. So this is how we actually show the amplitude is the correct chi amplitude because it has all the correct factorization. So as a rational function, it must be the correct one. Yeah.
So what tells you that it's just GR and not, say, GR plus some higher curvature terms or something?
Yeah, so here, something to justify is that it has the, it gives you the 3-point graviton amplitude and the factorization only propagate the graviton in this form. So this guarantees you that there's no other correction. So if you want to get other correction, you probably need to modify this guy. Yeah. So what else do I want to see? Yeah. So instead of giving you all the other theories we constructed from this, so this is actually the source of the whole construction. You start from this formula for n graviton scattering. You do operations to it. You can obtain any formula we obtain for other masses quantum field theory. But I want to pause here to tell you a few other nice properties because I want to really emphasize that the formula manifests those properties of this formula, of this graviton formula. So basically, I'll tell you. I will tell you that how you can see Weinberg's soft theorem, like a one-line proof from this formula, and also some relation to, I'll also show you how to obtain a gluon amplitude formula from here. So essentially, the one-line proof for Weinberg's soft theorem is like the following. So if you take the last particle to be soft, the first thing you notice that in the scattering equation, for the first n minus 1 particle, a from 1 to n minus 1, the nth particle just decouple because it becomes soft. And the nth equation still remain there and because every term is of the same order. And you want to use that as your building block. This is the first thing you, as your building block for the soft factor. This is the first thing you notice. The second thing is that this determinant of the matrix, if you expand it along your nth column and row, you realize that the all the terms drop except the CNN term. That's the only one that's dominant. So if I write it down, the determinant prime of n particle in the soft limit becomes CNN squared times the determinant prime of n minus 1 particle. Okay? So you just use this, you can prove the Weinberg soft theorem immediately. So how do I do that? Okay, so I write the nth particle integral as a contour integral because it still encloses the nth scattering equation, which I write here. It's just kn dot kb. B from 1 to n minus 1. So this is the contour that I want to enclose to send it to 0. This is my nth scattering equation. I haven't done anything. I only write the delta function as a pole. And I want to enclose on it. And my other particle, the integration over other sigmas doesn't involve sigma n at all. So I can write a d mu n minus 1 there because sigma n decouples. And also I have this determinant prime n minus 1. These are independent of the last particle, right? This is the n minus 1 particle system. Now, the only thing that's still not zero is the CNN squared. So what is CNN? I wrote it there. It's B from 1 to n minus 1, epsilon n, not KB, sigma n minus sigma. So these two the numerator and denominator are very similar. It's only this become epsilon. So now this is telling you that the when the last particle become, when the last graviton becomes soft, the n particle amplitude does want to become something like a, so here you can have an integration. This is the usual n minus 1 particle guy times something. But this something is quite complicated. It still involves sigma. So you might wonder what is going on here. So now you need to use a residue theorem. So this is the integral about sigma n. Instead of hitting this pole, you can hit all the other poles because there's no pole at infinity. So you write it as a summing over other poles. And here, this part is completely independent of sigma n. So you only hit pole here. So you might thought that these are double poles, but they are actually simple poles because once any pole goes to zero here, you also have a pole. So actually, by residue theorem, I can put a minus sign here when I do this. By residue theorem, this is given by minus the summing over all the poles here. So there are actually n minus 1 poles. So simply, you just, by residue theorem, is b from 1 to n minus 1. And what's the residue for each? So now you want to consider all the poles that sigma n becomes sigma b. What is the residue for that pole when you hit sigma n equals sigma b? It's obviously this numerator over this denominator. So this is how you see Weinberg's soft theorem, particle by particle. And of course, the rest is just the n minus 1 particle. So essentially, this is another evidence that all the Feynman diagrams is put into a single object. Because here you can see it particularly obvious from the from this factor. Usually people interpret this factor as the interaction of the nth particle with various different particles. So you need to sum it over all this Feynman diagram. But here, it's coming from the residue theorem of a single object. That's the pole that encloses the last section equation. If you use the residue theorem, actually becomes a lot of Feynman diagram. Yeah.
So can you go beyond leading order with this?
Yes, yes. So this is, I'll come to this. So this is the zeros order. So, you know, this is the Weinberg soft theorem. And in back in the 70s and also more recently by Strominger, and in the 70s by Lowe and collaborators. Now by Strominger and also Freddy, that they propose, actually you can go further. I mean, not from this formula, just generally, they propose that any quantum gravity S matrix element should not only have this Weinberg leading soft factor, but also its subleading corrections, actually subleading and sub-subleading. So there should exist S1 and S2 in this expansion of your soft parameter. And they argue that there should be a exact symmetry of the S matrix element of any, not only tree level, but also loop level amplitude. And this is the only one that I know can prove, formalism is the only one that I know can prove this statement in any dimension. So there are work by Volovich and the collaborators that showed you can also get S1, and then some other people showed you can get S2 by further expanding this determinant prime to sub-subleading and do contour integral here. So I won't show you that, but this is just a repeat of this Weinberg soft theorem. And I probably don't have time for other properties, but I'll immediately tell you the other two nice formulas for gluons and for the scalars in this same spirit. So the first thing I want to emphasize that this is exactly for n gravitons in Einstein gravity. But actually there is something you can write down, let me write it here, that you notice that this matrix is actually an anti-symmetric matrix. So its determinant is actually the square of the Fafian. So there's nothing prevent you for writing down two copies of Fafian that carries different polarization. So here is just because you want to consider graviton. It's symmetric and traceless, so you use the same. But you can generalize it to Fafian prime of a matrix with polarization epsilon and Fafian prime of a matrix with polarization epsilon tilde. So this will give you the system that gravitons is coupled to dilaton and the anti-symmetric tensor, the B field. So this will be our formula for such a system. It's the low energy action of bosonic closed string, if you want. And from here, it becomes very interesting that because you can now start to do operations to individual left or right hand side, left or right sector of the formula. So for example, I can keep this, and I want to change this. And I use it to get other formulas of other theories. So this is the spirit that we can get all these theories. But let me show you two particular nice examples. So for n gluon, can anybody guess what should be the formula? Of course, you only want one copy of polarization factor, not two copies. So this should go. And what is the rule of the thing that replaces this? It's exactly that Park-Taylor formula I put there. As I told you, this only accounts for half of the weight, so it cannot be the full answer. But it turns out you need one half of the answer to take into account the polarization, and one half to take into account the color information, because now you are dealing with a theory with color. So this is a Fatim prime of that object that I call C. So C is simply this sigma 1 minus sigma 2 to sigma n minus sigma 1 with the trace plus other permutation, the thing I wrote down there. Except now you realize in general, this object appears not just for the MHV sector. There it's simply that this sigma identify with the spinners, but in general, in any dimension, this object always appear as the building block for your gluon. So now you can also think, what if I put another natural thing to do is I can do it again, right? So here I replace one copy of my Fatim by a C. What if I replace this copy also by a C? Of course, you erase all the polarization, so you are dealing with the scalar theory. But now you get two copies of colors. So this is actually also the simplest colored scalar theory you can write down, which I found a bit surprised that it's not very well known. So this is simply the amplitude for the Lagrangian that you have a scalar that's colored under two copies of un, say un and un tilde, with only a phi cube interaction. So your scalar will have an index I and an index I tilde, similarly j, j tilde, and k, k tilde. And the coupling is just the structure constant for this two group. I mean, it can be any other group. It doesn't have to be un. So this is actually the simplest scalar Lagrangian you can write down. Of course, the usual phi cube with only a single scalar is the case that this becomes u1, say. And you can find the formula for that. So this is illustrating the idea that has been there also this recent years in amplitude business, that there's this color and kinematic duality, that you can start to replacing some copy of your color factor by kinematics, and you start to raise from scalars to mu's to gravity. Of course, you reduce the color, you increase the spin. And this is, to my knowledge, the most precise statement of the color kinematics duality. Okay, so in the final few minutes, let me just tell you how we apply some operation to this gravity formula, or this more precise, this gravity coupled to Dilaton and the B field system, to obtain not only these two theories, but also many others. I'll just give you a sketch what we did. I won't have time to. So there are three operations we found to apply to this gravity formula. Basically, the first one is just simply dimensional reduction. And the second one is the operation we call squeeze. It's quite strange. And the third one is even more strange. It's something you can call crazy dimensional reduction. So this is well known. If you start from the gravity system, you do dimensional reduction, you start to get KK modes. And for example, you can get Einstein-Maxwell or Einstein-Maxwell scalar if you start from the pure gravity system. And you can easily apply this dimensional reduction idea that your polarization, so if you reduce from d equals to d plus m to this small d space-time dimension, and this is the dimension of your internal space, you can write your momentum as purely external. So here is how I write it. This is the external one, and the internal momentum is zero. And you can also write your polarization with two possibilities. One is it's purely external. So this way, if you start from a gluon, you still get a gluon. Or if you start from a graviton, you still get a graviton. The other one is purely internal. So this is, if you put here some constant, so roughly here, I will put a constant in the m-dimensional space that's all zero except one value that's one. So this value will be the flavor of that scalar. So just the basis of the M-dimensional internal space. If you do this to our formula, you immediately obtain a formula for Einstein-Maxwell scalar. And why I want to emphasize this, because we will compare this normal dimension reduction to this crazy one. So basically, you get from this GR, of course, with dilaton and B field, you can do dimensional reduction, you get Einstein-Maxwell. Say we only do it to one copy of our Fatian. We only do it to Fatian psi with epsilon, not with epsilon tilde. So with epsilon tilde, it's always like this. If we do this, we don't get scalar. We only get Einstein-Maxwell. Okay? And then if you started from Young-Mills theory, of course, if you do dimensional reduction, what you get is this Young-Mills scalar theory where your scalar has the flavored under the SOM group, and this is the low energy action for M d brains, and these are all very trivial. So what we found, another thing is this squeezing operation that can allow you to go directly from here to here to arrive at some more interesting theories. So Einstein Young-Mills or something we call generalized Young-Mills scalar. Equivalently, you can go from here. And what you are doing is essentially making the photons becoming gluons, so making them non-abelian. So here, the photons don't interact with themselves. They only interact through the graviton sense, the tensor mode. So by a squeezing operation, which I don't have time to go through, in our formula, you find that you can actually turn some graviton directly into gluon, or equivalently, you can turn some photon to make them non-abelian. So you can arrive at this theory. Of course, there are some more complicated formula for the system of graviton and gluon together. Of course, once you are here, it's very trivial to go to the pure Young-Mills theory, because you can just turn off the graviton. So this is one way that you can go from our two Fatian system to a single Fatian with this Park-Taylor object, that you can actually derive it like this. And similarly, if you do it here, what is this theory? I haven't told you. This theory is that here the scalars don't have a cubic interaction. They only interact through gluon, or they have a quartic one. And by generalized the Young-Mills scalar, it's a theory that you compactify with flux such that your Lagrangian is the standard Young-Mills scalar together with this cubic interaction. So your scalar is also colored under some flavor group, UN. And of course, if you turn off the Young-Mills coupling here, you get that theory that I talk about there, this colored phi q. So you see that there's two sequence of things that everything just start from GR. I can do these operations to get to other theories. And it's always of a general theory that you can somehow turn off. Here you turn off the Young-Mills coupling, you get back here. You turn off the G Newton, you get here. And there, similarly, you turn off Young-Mills coupling or lambda, you get that system. So I want to just spend a few minutes telling you what is this crazy dimensional reduction, which will greatly extend this landscape of massless theories. This is the third part of my talk. At the moment, we only find one more column here, but maybe there are more theories that you will see. And these are the theories for photons and scalars. Exactly follow this pattern. So what do we mean by crazy dimensional reduction? We mean something that you do almost this, but instead, the internal space is not constant. It's also kinematic. So this doesn't really make sense to me. But this is somehow we found that you can obtain theories like Born-Ingfeld or DBI or nonlinear second model from theories here. So let me tell you exactly what do I mean by that. So if you still keep your Ka like this, but instead if you replace your epsilon A by zero and Ka itself. Of course, you can put this small Ka. Of course, you can put a length scale here to make it dimensionless. If you do this instead of this, so this is like a double field theory because I have to start from D equals D plus D. And I do this reduction that my polarization has only internal degrees of freedom, but it is proportional to my momentum to the momentum of the same particle. So this amounts to the following replacement rule. It's just taking all the epsilon dot epsilon, taking all the k dot k to just the k dot k, right? The internal, the external guy, the lower dimension one. And all the epsilon dot k to zero, because all my epsilon now only live in internal space. And all my epsilon dot epsilon becomes something proportional L squared to this k dot k. So you can see that this is also dimension reduction in the sense that it reduces the spin. It's, if you start from graviton, you obviously should get some vector particle. But that vector particle is not just some gluon or trivial Maxwell field. It's going to have higher derivative. It has higher power in momentum. So what do you get? If you start from here, do that operation, you get Born-Ehrenfeld theory. So we have a formula for this Born-Ehrenfeld theory, which basically looks like you start from this 2 Fockian. The second Fockian, you keep it intact. And the first Fockian, you do this replacement. Essentially, you just get a Fockian prime A squared. This A is the matrix. So I don't know where it is. So you have this A, B, C, D part, and A is the K dot K part only. So now it becomes two copy of this A, because the epsilon dot epsilon part also become K dot K. So this is how you get BI from GR. And if you do it to Einstein-Maxwell, or equivalently, if you further do the normal dimensional reduction to the right sector, you can get dBI. So equivalently, it's down here. I mean, I don't want to draw all these arrows. I just keep this arrow to tell you that everyone here on the first column, if you do the crazy dimensional reduction, let me use a different color. You always get a correspondence theory here. So we actually also find an extended dBI or generalized the dBI. That's coming from either making the scalars non-abelian here or the crazy dimensional reduction from EYI. And if you go to the case that photons got decoupled completely and the scalars are only single trace now, it becomes a nonlinear sigma model. So actually there's a theory that interpolate between dBI and nonlinear sigma model, which we didn't find in the literature. So it'd be, if anybody know what the theory is, please tell me. So it's like the opposite, that we know all its S matrix element and we still don't know what's the, I mean, we can write down it's Lagrangian, but it's a conjecture that we strip off the vertices, the infinite contact terms from the S matrix, but we still don't know what this theory is. I mean, it must be some also low energy effective theory of the brains. And there's a final last theory that Kurt was very familiar with, is that if I do this crazy dimensional reduction, not only to the left part, but also to the right part, so I get another copy of this, which means I get Fockian prime A to the fourth. This is arguably one of the simplest integrand you can write down, because you want to have weight minus 4. Each Fockian prime A gives you weight minus 1 under SL2. So if you do this, in other words, if you do another crazy dimension reduction to BI to smash all the photons into scalars with even higher derivative or shift symmetry, you get this special Galilean theory that Kurt and the collaborator has identified with some even higher shift symmetry than a usual Galilean theory. So this is simply our, from our perspective, its S matrix is simply coming from such an integrand. And there are also some other relations that I don't have time to mention between these columns called KLT or double copy relation in these two directions. That this is currently the web we find for this massless theories that seems to have a very nice description in terms of our formula. Of course, I said other theories must fit in, but whether they have nice integrand as these theories, we still don't know. Okay, so I'll stop here.
How did you know that you were going to get Born-Ehrenfeld by doing this operation?
We don't know. So this is completely, yeah, the reason we know that this is a Born-Ehrenfeld is by computing its S matrix and compare with the Born-Ehrenfeld S matrix. So in other words, this operation is completely mysterious from its action, for example.
How did you guess all this? So you guess Born-Ehrenfeld, then you guess special Galilean and so on?
Well, the story is we first get the formula for this one, which is very nice. And we confirmed that it is the Born-Ehrenfeld formula because it gives the correct S matrix. And then we realized that this comes from such an operation, right? So then you can, once you have the operation, you can apply it to everybody you have here, you get all these theories. And if you apply it again, you get this special Galilean. So actually here, the nonlinear signal model, the scalar DBI, and the Galilean are the three theories also appear as theories that has higher softer limit than usual. So in a paper by Yaroslav and friends, that they try to classify all these theories with a single scalar by their softer limit. And these are the theories that has softer limit that's not predicted by dimensional analysis. So there's some reason that these theories are singled out as theories for scalars or photons, that they are special. They are not something random, but we don't understand it yet. I mean, one reason could be this operation is something that gives you this enhanced softer limit. So if you believe those are the only theories with enhanced softer limit, then you must land on them.
But for all these theories, you have data. You can use DCFW or something.
Yes.
Else.
So actually, for these theories, you can just use Feynman diagram because they are scalars. So it's relatively easier to compute it to a high number of points. Of course, to prove it. So right now, all these are proven. And we know that it's the correct formula by two steps. One step, you show that it has the correct factorization, and then you show that it has the a large Z behavior under BCFW, then it's done. And this theory is actually more difficult. So we compare, say, up to 10 point that is the correct amplitude. We also know that under factorization, the internal particle must be such that it's a Born-Ehrenfeld or nonlinear signal model. But you cannot really prove it because you don't know if the amplitude, if the answer from your formula has some other weird poles that's not the factor. So you prove that your formula factorizes on each physical pole. But you don't know if it has any weird pose. In this series, you know, because then you show it satisfied BCFW. There hasn't been any BCFW for this series because you have a pole at infinity. So this is a technical issue that this column remains conjecture.
Sorry, yeah. These are scalars, you said? For that column, they are scalars?
Yes. I mean, here there are photons, but yeah, you can regard this as all scalar theories, sometimes with photons in these two cases.
Not the first.
In this three, actually, they're photons. But you can focus on the special case, except this one, everyone is just scalar theory, right? And even for them, you don't have a recursion relation because, essentially because there are infinite contact terms that you, the large Z fall off is not fast enough in this theory. So we don't have a proof yet for this theory. So we know it must be correct because it has all the physical poles, but.
Can you use arguments or technology like this to give an indirect proof that you can't couple higher spin fields to the graviton, you know, in a sensible way?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Because, I mean, you can take your determinant and you can split it up and get lower spins, clearly. But
yeah,
can you show you can't write down
some parameters? There are some attempts that we try to make higher spin objects. For example, you can make, instead of two copy of this far thing, you make three copy. But of course, there's this fundamental constraint that you have to make it weight minus 4. So once you make it three copy of far thing, you have to divide by something to make it. So all this attempt we tried, it gives you non-local poles and so on. So it's not a physical sensible theory, but I don't have a proof that it's impossible. I mean, there's another direction you can try. Oh, what if I have three copy of such guys? I mean, it's not going to higher spin, but then you need to divide by something. Again, it gives you So in some sense, if you focus on a single particle case, that these are the only three things you can write down. So there's a general formula that we wrote down for spin S, that you have Fafian to the S power, and this color part to the 2 minus S power. So obviously, this works for S equals 0, 1, and 2. They give you the cubic scalar, Young Mills, and gravity, but for any negative S or for S bigger than 2, it seems there's nothing preventing you from writing it down, but then the answer is definitely not local and unitary and so on. So I won't say I have any definite answer to that question, but that's what we tried.
There are no nice formulas for fermions?
Oh, there are. So in 4D, for example, we definitely know how to write down the formula for massless QCD, for example. But fermion seems to be something, at least myself, I'm not sure how to write it in any dimension as beautiful as this. I mean, in 4D, you can write down, it's essentially the projection of Witten's of RST formula into the gluon fermion sector that you can write down for massless QCD. So as I said, if you tell me what the amplitudes are written in a local form, namely it's always of this cubic diagram with some numerator. If you have contact term, you can put them in this, you can put in the numerator also some propagator to make it always a cubic diagram. And then there's always a translation into the integrand. So whatever fermion you have or other theory, as long as it's local and unitary, you can come up with an integrand. Whether or not the integrand is nice, it's not guaranteed.
Can you write similar formulas for scattering in curved space?
That's a very good question. Until recently, I haven't thought about that. And I was thinking maybe one place to start with is this Malling amplitude business. If you think about it, you can probably just, I mean, one natural thing to try is just replace this Mandelstam by the gamma ij, whatever they have in the Malling space. And the reason I think it might work is because it all the factorization properties are similar. Of course, there you have higher spin particles and so on. But yeah, that's something one might, yeah, that's something worth trying. I never concrete get anything.
So normally you don't want to solve the equations, right? In bracket, you want to avoid solving it.
Right.
So are there ways of avoiding by
yes.
blowing the contour and instead of taking the solutions, taking the other singularities?
So I have to say, in all these theories, we already essentially know. I mean, so the way to do it is actually focusing on this phi cube theory. So this phi cube theory, we found the phi cube theory is the first one that we know how to get a final answer without solving any scattering equation. So basically by proving that if you put two Park-Taylor denominator of arbitrary ordering, like a C of alpha and C of beta to your formula, you do the summing over solution for this object. So this object is nothing but some Park-Taylor. You have alpha 1 and alpha 2 and so on. This is beta 1 and beta 2 and so on. There's two Park-Taylor sitting here. If you do it, you find that you get summing over some cubic diagrams, arbitrary cubic diagrams that are both alpha ordered and beta ordered. So this is the identity that you want to use to compute any amplitude. Because in all these examples we have, you have a Fafian and something, you can expand it in terms of some ordered Park-Taylor with some numerator. The numerator will generally depend on polarization and so on, right? So if you know any Park-Taylor factor, two Park-Taylor factor gives you some cubic diagram, the final answer is exactly this cubic diagram just with the corresponding numerators. So this is in practice how we compute it. Unfortunately, this decomposition of Fafian psi or Fafian prime of A into Park-Taylor gets more and more complicated when you go to very high number of points. So for example, this can be done at 10 point, but higher than that, I never tried. It's in principle, it's a way of avoiding computing any solutions of scattering equation because they can always be decomposed into this. I mean, it's five particles, we can already understand this. So if you solve the equation, you get the two solutions, they have square root and so on. And you plug it in the end, the square root cancel. Of course, you get a rational answer. But instead, you don't need to do that. You can express the final answer as the sum and product of the two solutions, and that's how you avoid really writing them down. And that's basically the idea to generalize to higher point.
And this sort of identity, how do you prove? Is it simple? Or?
Yeah, this is simple. This is the proof of this is just to show that these two are the same rational function, that they have the same pole and the same residues. And this we did like a year ago in our paper. But the decomposition into this is generally complicated. So there's nothing prevent you from doing that, but yeah, it gets more and more difficult.
But but just more naively, you could imagine encircling the poles of the scattering equation and blowing the contour and taking the poles.
Yeah, so I think
like you were doing in your proof of the soft theorem.
Right, and that's also something Freddy and Gomez they were trying to go along this direction of some contour. I think it's definitely doable, but again, I never have a general proof how to, what the procedure is.
Any other questions?
Well, then thank Sonia again.
Thank you.